This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Now, here's Frank Morano.
The secret got out that on special days of the year, the sun, which is normally sort of moving its sunset point along the horizon, will exactly line up with the street grid of Manhattan.
I didn't believe it. I really did. I thought it was going to be from an airplane. You know, something from space would have never crossed my mind. And it, you know, just so happened to land through our house.
Ignition 2-1. And liftoff of the final United Launch Alliance Delta IV heavy rocket carrying NROL 70 for the National Reconnaissance Office and closing Delta's six-decade legacy of excellence in space.
Those are a few of the items we will be discussing with the one and only Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky, on another edition of Cosmic Conversation.
The Other Side of Midnight presents... From the spiral, to the elliptical, to the lenticular, to the irregular, to the quasars, galaxies. Where are we in the cosmic evolutionary picture? Always remember to keep your eyes to the skies. The following conversations are Cosmic Conversations with Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky.
Let us welcome back to the program Steve Cates. If you think you traveled a while, maybe you drove 3 or 4 hours to drive somewhere that was supposedly going to have a great view of the eclipse. Well, Dr. Sky went all the way to Texas to have a look at the eclipse. Steve, it's great to have you back. I'm glad you survived the eclipse and the Lone Star State.
Yes. Good morning, Frank, and good to be back on Cosmic Conversations on your show, The Other Side of Midnight. Yes, a rather interesting trip, well over 2,000 miles of driving back and forth. Once again, I was the MC of a great Texas music event, the TexClipse Music Festival. But more important than that, what could be more important? Great Texas hospitality, Frank. Great barbecue, by the way. That was awesome. And a somewhat decent view of the eclipse, because many people in your listening area, they know that the weather conditions were kind of the opposite. Down in Texas, it was, you know, predicted to be generally very clear, if not partly cloudy, and the Northeast and Midwest, cloudy, but just the opposite happened. So I hope other people along eclipse path become umbrophiles. That is, those that seek out the dark shadow of the moon.
So what did you think, Steve? You know, I saw a lot of commentary, especially in the talk radio sphere and the social media sphere. And I think it would be difficult to find two groups that are more likely to be cynical and dismissive than those two areas. But some people thought it was a little overblown. They thought that the eclipse wasn't all that we made it out to be, that we hyped it up too much. What were your impressions?
Well, I think the media in generally, I mean, they tend to exaggerate sometimes, and we talk about stories and going back to other stories, like always an asteroid coming close to the Earth the size of, you know, 10 times the size of Taylor Swift in height, or 10 times the size of the Empire State Building. But in all due respect to the subject, I think a lot of people may not have really understood what goes on during a total eclipse of the sun. And I know in the New York listening area and other parts in the Northeast and other sides of the eclipse path, it was upwards of 90%+. You know, that's not total. But that experience to me is great. But I think in general, the media did an okay job of letting people know. And, you know, some were a little overblown, you know, but always the safety measure about protecting your eyes was, I think, well done.
So it sounds like you think it was worth making the trip in your case.
Well, absolutely. Not only the fun of being there and getting up in front of people that, you know, have a deep interest in this. And we had people, Frank, from all over the place. I mean, we had people from New York State in Texas. We had people from Canada, people from Ireland, all over the world. And yes, I think it was great because then everybody there was going, hey, Steve, Dr. Sky, when's the next one? And now the eclipse fever, that part of it is really, you know, taking shape. And lots to report here about future events for people to get into the deep, dark shadow of the moon. And some of these are world trek events that people can look forward to now. But get set and get early because, boy, rooms in our area were going for $2,000 a night.
Wow.
And, of course, people were paying it. And some people did the camping out. Camping style, and they had just, I'm sure, a good time too.
So in terms of what you saw and the other folks in your area or folks that were in the path of totality, how different was that experience from my experience looking at it in New York?
Well, absolutely. Light years, and no pun intended there, sure. But here we go. 91% in New York is still a deep partial eclipse. And it, many people might have thought that it gets dark as almost darkened as night. You know, even with a partial eclipse, obviously that's not true. But the great bit of being in the totality path is, even with clouds, you look up moments before the sun, let's say it goes to 95% covered, you start to see that ominous shadow moving at you at 2,000 miles per hour. Mm. That's incredible. And if you had clear skies, as many people did up in, say, the northeast part of the United States, up in Niagara Falls, I know we got reports people were cheering and going wild. But that, to me, was so different. So the big difference is seeing the darkness of totality is obviously a much bigger experience than any part of partial eclipses.
We're going to take your calls throughout the hour. There's one line open if you want to jump in with a question, 800-848-9222, not just about the eclipse, but really anything space-related or related to the stars or even beyond that, aviation and so forth. We've got a real expert that we're privileged to have access to this hour, 800-848-9222. Steve, were you a Star Trek fan as a younger man? I'm guessing you were.
I was, and I think I became a bigger Star Trek fan later in life, and the reason being is I never really had the chance to watch the entire series.
Mm-hmm.
But I went down to my local store, you know, records and video and stuff like that, and actually bought the whole series, and I really got into so many of the different episodes. Of course, you know, William Shatner, the legend himself, I know you've had the privilege and honor of being with him, and I've had the honor of just doing a short interview on the phone, but the point is, the entire cast of that show is just so incredible because take a look as they're on the Starship Enterprise and the other fleet craft in that space series. You see things that were so unbelievably, you know, way ahead of their time. You look at large screen TVs as the main monitor when they're sitting there in the control, you know, location of the Starship and so many other technologies. Look at the phasers that they were using and all that type of technology, which was way ahead of its time. Gene Roddenberry, obviously a genius. And that legacy, I think, is something interesting. But I talked to a lot of young folks today. And sadly, I mean, not polling everybody like a true scientific poll, but a lot of the younger folks, the younger generation, I don't think they have that deep interest in that as much as, you know, I've been to Comic-Con, I'm sure you have many times, and, you know, I kind of surveyed people, we were doing some interviews, and they're more interested more in the higher tech stuff that's coming out now, and you see a lot on Netflix and other series.
Well, one of the reasons I ask, because one of the things that was so fascinating about that show and about the Next Generation is sort of the mission that's spelled out in the opening narration, either by William Shatner in the first series or Patrick Stewart in the second series, which I can't believe it was almost 40 years ago that show debuted. It's hard to believe.
Yeah, absolutely.
They both describe seeking out strange new worlds and new civilizations. Now, we are in 21st century Earth, a long ways away, apparently, from seeking out strange new civilizations, but we are trying to find some strange new worlds. I'm curious what the story is with Kepler-186f. They're saying that this could be an Earth-like planet. Is there any chance that this is an Earth-like planet and, I don't know, maybe either has life on it or maybe one day can sustain life if we wanted to set up some sort of a colony there?
Well, absolutely, Frank. And this goes to an anniversary, which is actually today, April 17th, 2014. The true number is 136F. But either way, there's so many of these different extrasolar planets out there. But here's the point of this. Here's an object that lies very close in relativistic terms in what we call a habitable zone or this Goldilocks zone. What's that? So whatever star you have, like our sun, we know we have this habitable zone because we're here and things seem to flourish, even if we all can't get along. But in this particular case, with this exoplanet, you find out that it's 10%, at least they feel this way. And these are all done. How do they even know this exists? They do this by a method called transit imaging. So what happens is they look at an object in a telescope and they see this object transiting the parent star. So they've come with calculations saying it's probably 10% larger than the Earth, 500 light years away from us, and that it's in that habitable zone. But strange enough, it's not around a sun-like star. It's around a red dwarf star. So in other words, a very old star that's in its very end of life, which is even more phenomenal. And this particular object itself is located 40 million miles away from the star, and it goes around it once every 130 days. But no, they don't have any image of this. I mean, even if you took the giant James Webb telescope, you're not going to see what, oh, wow, look at those oceans, and those look like land masses. But the calculations are this is probably one of the most prolific of all the candidates for exoplanetary, you know, habitability, if you want to call it. It might have that Earth-like existence or you know, ingredients like water, atmosphere, because if it were too close, it would burn up. And you and I talked in previous editions here on Cosmic Conversations about a planetary object that's 100% lava. So we can discount that one pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah.
Not having any life as we might know it. But it's a fascinating thing how they do that. And it's sad that the Kepler mission is gone. But the point I'm trying to make here is of all these candidates, this 136F of the four major objects and five now that go around that star, this one may have the highest probability so far of being Earth-like or lifelike as we might know it.
Well, that's pretty exciting, I think. All right, a lot of people very eager to chat with you, 800-848-9222. Let's begin with Casey listening on WFDF AM 910, the superstation in Detroit. Hi, Casey.
Hey, how are we doing? No, actually, I stream it on the...
Whatever, you're in Detroit. What's your question?
The what?
What's your question, Casey? Go ahead.
Oh, no, there's no question. I went to Cleveland to see the totality of the eclipse, and it was the most phenomenal thing I've ever seen. Went into totality, the flash that when the moon actually took over and the ring of fire around the sun, and when it was 4 minutes of total darkness, and then when the moon came back up. Well, my question is, how did the eclipse go from west to east when everything else rises in the east and sets in the west?
Well, Casey, congratulations on seeing a total eclipse, because I know that the big baseball stadium there, Progressive Field, they had a lot of folks watching it, too. But here's the answer. As much as this may sound strange, when you see the sun rise in the east and set in the west, the Earth is rotating from west to east. So the events are taking place where the objects in the sky are moving from the west. As you notice, the moon came across the sun from the right side, which means it's moving in a trajectory of west to east. So the rotation of the Earth gives us the illusion, which it's turning west to east, that everything is rising simply because we don't really pay attention to it every day. We just depend on the sun. Hey, air, it rose in the east and it moves all the way to the west. So there's your answer. But I'm impressed that you got to see it and you saw those red prominences. Is that what I'm hearing around the edge of the sun?
Actually, I disconnected Casey to make room for another caller. But I did want to ask you, you know, one of the stories that's gotten a lot of attention is that, you know, we talk a lot about space junk and the hazards of space junk to our satellites, to our space missions and things like that. What we don't generally think of, what we don't generally talk about, is the danger of space junk crashing into our house. But apparently there might have been exactly that situation with space junk from the International Space Station hitting a house in Florida. What happened? And how does this happen?
Well, this is bizarre. Back in March of 2021, the ISS, on a regular series of, you know, expulsions of things out into space, they've done space suits and loaded them up with garbage. And you could see this man or woman like formation going away, you know, burning up to, you know, get rid of their trash. This is the old days. But in this case, Frank, this is a big pallet of batteries and it's called pallet number 9. They had 350 of these batteries on there. I don't think they were NICAD, you know, or lithium ions like in Teslas or whatever. But what happened is that whole pallet was sent out on the assumption that it would slowly deorbit, and it did, and that it would incinerate. But not so fast, folks, because on that exposed pallet 9, maybe one or two of those 2-pound cylinders actually made it through, and it hit a man's home in Naples, Florida. So could you imagine, you're sitting home, I don't know if it was day or night, probably more exciting if they watched it coming through at night like a meteor. But it literally is material now identified by space scientists. In other words, the pallet was released, but it didn't come down out of the atmosphere in a day or so. This thing slowly comes down. So we have the issue that, yes, stuff does come down from space. The most notorious was the Skylab reentry in 79 when I was living in New York. We covered this extensively, and it was amazing. We had like 5,000 people out in a New Jersey theater one time in 79 watching this wobbling spacecraft. And what happened? Some of the debris, actually a lot of debris, crash landed in Australia. So watch out what's above our heads, because what's going on, Frank? More and more of it is being sent up.
800-848-9222. Pam is in Manhattan. Hi, Pam.
Hi.
Good morning.
I saw the eclipse, and I don't want to, well, anyway, but it was things surrounding it that I was curious about. When I was coming home Tuesday night, around midnight, got off the bus around 125th Street, and from the area of Morningside Gardens and the projects, there were this cacophony of birds, thousands. The sound of birds songs I'd never heard before, that they seemed under, it was a very chaotic, and also at midnight, highly unusual. And I wondered if perhaps it was a residual thing from maybe an aftershock was coming, and sure enough, the next morning, there was a pretty strong aftershock from the earthquake of the previous week. But then I heard on the radio, and I haven't heard any mention of it since, there was a meteorite and a fireball.
Right, in New Jersey.
Well, Pam, you're right, and good morning to you. This is interesting. You got to experience the eclipse, but what you're talking about, a rustling of birds at midnight, yes, it could be related. You know, animals are extremely sensitive. I'm not a ornithologist or a bird expert by any chance, but I can just say that anytime these aftershocks occur, animals like dogs and cats, all animals have, even insects, have this extremely, extrasensory perception, if you want to call it. But that could have been related to aftershocks from that particular earthquake that you experienced a little while ago. And also the fact that, as we're talking about this, that, you know, so many of these other related things, that meteor fireball, who knows? But you've had a lot of activity, Pam, in the New York area, eclipses, earthquakes, and meteors. So it always, I think, has a connection deeply to animals and their behavior.
800-848-9222. You know, speaking of eclipses, I know we said the next eclipse that we could see in the United States was not until, I think, 2044. Is that right?
It is. August 23rd. Now, here we go. And I could go into more detail. I could also mention, if we have time, to some of the next worldwide.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to ask you about.
Right. The long term is August 23rd, 2044. It'll only be a 2-minute and 4-second eclipse, but hey, wait a minute. Only is great if you've never seen one, and if you love this stuff. It touches the top area of Montana and North Dakota. Hmm. Now, that's deep in the heart of late summer. And the other biggie is the giant one in America, like the repetition of this one. It's August 12th, 2045. That's 6 minutes and 6 seconds, but I looked at the calendar, and I'll be like, I don't know, 90-something years old. So I got to change my retirement plan or whatever to be around. But the other one, Frank, if you want to go, and this is interesting for everybody, if you're a world traveler or you love eclipses, mark August 12th, 2026 in Iceland and in areas of Spain. There'll be a 2-minute and 8-second total eclipse. And the beat goes on. The biggie of the worldwide travel is August 2, 2027. How about this? 6 minutes and 23 seconds as it crosses Spain and Libya, but the 6-minute, 23-second one is right next to Luxor and the pyramids. That would be quite spectacular.
800-848-9222. We're going to continue with Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky, on another edition of Cosmic Conversations straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano. It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
Minutes after the hour, this is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. We are in the midst of some cosmic conversations with Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky, as we explore what's going on in the night sky and in general, whatever happens when you look up. Steve, I'm talking to you now from the island of Manhattan. Apparently, there's something called Manhattan Henge that is a pretty big deal, and this occurs fairly rarely. What exactly is Manhattan Henge? When can people see it, and how best can they observe it?
Well, in a replicant of Stonehenge, of course. I've never been there, but many listeners may have, where you see this alignment between stones. But what about the great big chasms in New York City, as we, of course, know, with big buildings in east-westerly direction? Take 14th Street, 23rd Street, 34th Street, 42nd Street, and 57th Street. There happens to be a time of year, and many New Yorkers may know this already, but this is revelation to everybody, and they can also have these in other cities. Between May 29th, or starting May 29th, at exactly 8:12 p.m., you know, Eastern Daylight Time, you would be, if you're standing on one of those streets across town, looking across to the west, let's say, you would see the sun, the full disk of the sun. Don't stare at it, but you'll see the light streaming through the caverns of these skyscrapers and buildings. And then you can get a half sun that happens sometime between May 28th, where it begins then. That's fascinating. And so many of the folks out there that are professional photographers, artists, they've done this. That's just incredible. I've seen it when I lived in New York. I've seen it a few times, and I thought that was pretty spectacular. Just that I didn't have a decent, you know, camera at the time. That was way before we had these smartphones. But that's something quite fascinating. You see the alignment of the streets, particularly in Manhattan, as they look east-west, and you can see this amazing beam of light if the skies are clear. So that's fascinating stuff.
Dave is in Orange. Hello, Dave.
Thanks. Bailey's Beads. My wife and I saw Bailey's Beads. And I want to thank
where
you,
were
Mr.
you
Cates.
Where were you when you saw it? I'm sorry. So where were you when you saw the eclipse?
North of Bangor in a little town called Patton. There were some people that had... Yeah. And with a device, they looked at Mount Katahdin, 24.6 miles... of clear viewing. Greatest light show ever. Greatest light show ever.
Say this.
Thanks for taking my call, Frank.
No, that's awesome what he's talking about to describe it. So at these eclipses, Frank, when you have this totality, and being that the moon is larger than the sun, so you get this longer duration eclipse, the mountains are the edges of the moon. There's light that is streaming, as he saw, and many people have photographed. Light will be streaming through these big mountains on the surface of the moon. And many, many people don't know this, but I found this out, and I had to do some research a long time ago. There are mountains on the surface of the moon that are higher than Mount Everest, even 35,000, maybe 36,000 feet in height. So what he saw, Dave saw, and others, is this transition when the moon is just about to get ready to go total, the eclipse, that is, or total coverage. This light is streaming, looking like pearls on a necklace. This is a beautiful sight. But that's when you have to be careful, because when do you take the solar glasses off? Even Bailey's Beads may be bright, but cameras capture it. He's lucky to see it, and I hope many people listening get a chance to see a total solar eclipse.
Steve, I have been commenting for the entire time that we've been on the air, not just these last 2 years, about the ongoing tensions between the United States and Russia. And one of my great concerns has been and remains that when you have the two biggest nuclear powers engaging in things like proxy wars and increasing hostilities and lack of communication, that an accident could lead to some very disastrous disastrous problems for the whole planet, honestly. Tell me what happened with this Russian satellite that got a little too close to a U.S. spacecraft.
Well, we start off, Frank, and to answer the question completely, we start off with low Earth orbit. It's getting extremely crowded. What do we do about it? So here's the story. We find out that space scientists say back on February 28th, we found out that a dead Russian spy satellite called Cosmos 2221 gets very, very close, dangerously close, might I add, to a NASA satellite, which its acronym is TIME. That's an environmental satellite and it studies the weather and the ionosphere. How about this? It was 378 miles above the Earth where these two objects are. But Frank, they came within 30 feet. Let me repeat this, 30 feet of each other. Now, if they had collided, this would have been a big space disaster with debris. And this is interesting because a long time ago, an aerospace engineer developed this thing called the Kessler syndrome. He brought it out. And what's the Kessler syndrome? It's like a single collision between two objects with its debris then has a domino effect, like billiard balls smacking each other in a tight, confined area. So that's interesting. But now look at the timeline we're talking about. We're not hearing about this until now. So can you imagine how close many of these other satellites are? And not to sound like the Russians are guilty all the time on this. I mean, who knows really what's going on up there? But truth is that one of their spacecraft and a Chinese spacecraft has been trailing some of our secret space satellites, the surveillance ones. And even the Chinese satellite has this arm that allegedly can come out and release some things. So that low Earth orbit area, sadly, may be the next realm of warfare, sad to say. And that's why we have a Space Force. Lucky for us on that.
Absolutely. 800-848-9222. Don is in Long Beach. Hi, Don.
Hi, Frank. Hi, Dr. Sky. Question. We look for life on other planets. We've landed on Mars. We drill, we dig, and analyze the soil. Have we been trying to find examples of, like, I would call it anecdotal life, where another civilization may have landed on Mars or some other satellite, or maybe just has, you know, a space probe somewhere out there, you know, emitting signals? Have we tried to identify anything like that?
Well, Don, from what we know, I mean, maybe there's secret stuff that we never will be told about, like what Frank talks about all the time about the whole UFO concept. Mm-hmm. What's interesting, Don, is this. Everything we've done on Mars is all robotic spacecraft searching for organic life. In other words, similar, obviously, to what's here. So everything so far, unless we're being lied to, I mean, I keep that option open that, you know, not to sound conspiratorial, we haven't found any direct evidence of life as we know it. In other words, we haven't pulled up amino acids. The closest we ever came, and this was a controversial thing, the two Viking spacecraft that landed on Mars back around 1976, there was a report that one of the Vikings dug into the soil of Mars and allegedly found something, but it was later then reported that there might have been a contaminated probe. So in other words, when you see those people in the white suits that are like in those computer rooms, you know, working in the developing silicon chips, maybe one of those things got contaminated. So we haven't found anything yet. And it's interesting because we've only been exploring the whole universe with spacecraft, what, not even 100 years. So look at the beat of how long the universe has been around. So I'm going to keep optimism open and hope we find it just like you do.
Thanks, Don. Let me ask you about a story that the owner of our whole radio network, probably our most important listener at this time of the morning, John Catsimatidis, yes, shared with us right before we got on the air this morning. Headline, NASA spacecraft suddenly starts transmitting mysterious gibberish 15 billion miles from Earth. That's really interesting and kind of cool. What do we make of this? What is this NASA spacecraft and why is it sending us gibberish?
Well, good morning, John, if you're listening. And it's interesting that he brings this to our attention. On his program, the Cats Roundtable, which I'm proud to be part of with John, we've talked about a little bit about the mysterious things going on with Voyager 1. Well, think about it. This spacecraft is 15 billion miles out. It's left the area where the sun, if you had your arm reach out as far as you can, that solar wind from the sun has ended and is well beyond the reach of, let's say, your arm in a graphic sense. But what's interesting on this, they're believing, that is the space scientists, that the flight data system computer has errors. And that little tiny chip that's on there, remember, this is 70s technology. that that particular flight data system chip is 3% corrupted. And what it does, it sends back information back to the Earth. Remember, 23 or 20, almost 24 hours it takes once it sends information. That tiny little signal is no more wattage than the refrigerator light bulb that you have in a refrigerator. And this is even more bizarre. It has 240,000 times less memory than your smartphone. That is the spacecraft. Get a load of this, Frank, with only 64 kilobytes of memory storage. So something weird is going on. It's probably at its end life cycle, but I'm amazed, and I think everybody is. I mean, don't you think that's incredible? That it even can have a signal picked up that far away with such minimal technology from a long time ago. Who knows what's going to happen to it? Probably go dormant, and it won't get to a nearest star for 40,000 years. That's amazing.
800-848-9222. Paul is in Connecticut. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Dr. Sky. I had a question about something I heard a little bit about recently. It's called the Devil Comet. It might be visible from Earth.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Paul, it's called Comet 12P. It was the 12th comet ever discovered way back when, around 1812. And it's called Pons Brooks, the last names of the two people who discovered it. Now, while in Texas, I said to myself, I'm going to take advantage of their dark skies. So I get the binoculars out in the clear sky and I find it. I got the telescope out and I find it. Now, why is it called a devil's comet? Because apparently when it's coming around the sun, it actually had what looked like horns on it. And at one time of its life, as it's moving through space, incredible. It's about 10 mile in diameter piece of ice, let's say. And it also looked like the Millennium Falcon, like a Star Wars thing. But what's going on in this, Paul, is really weird. You can actually still see it if you have a pair of binoculars. Look into the western sky. You'll see Jupiter sitting there in the west, kind of low, maybe 15 degrees high. The comet, if you took a pair of binoculars and just sweep a few degrees to the lower right, now you need a dark sky. But the point of the matter is this comet is called a cryocomet, meaning it's putting out ice volcanoes off of its surface. So it's blowing out chunks of ice. It's very strange, and it's what they call volatiles on the surface of the comet. So it's like if you were landed there, don't plant your RV or your tent down because it has geysers of material that shoot ice out, giving it the look of a devil's horn. But it didn't look like that to me. It looked like a smudge with a little dot, but that's cool. Comets, I love them. That's a good one.
Thanks, Paul. 800-848-9222. If you want to comment or, excuse me, if you have a question for Dr. Sky, we have three open lines. Now's the time. What's coming up in the coming days and weeks that people can enjoy having a look at, either with the naked eye or if they happen to have a pair of binoculars or a telescope?
Well, Frank, it's interesting. The moon goes to the opposite distance that it was when it was at the eclipse. It was at perigee on the 8th. That's where you got an eclipse. But now on the 20th, the moon will be farthest away for the month. So it's getting brighter. It's moving every night into, you know, just past first quarter. It goes to gibbous. But here's something interesting. There's a meteor shower that's going to take place on the evening hours into the morning of the 21st and 22nd. And this is for people who have dark skies and can stay up late at night. Listening to shows like this, of course, entertaining us. So here we go. It's called the Lyrid Meteor Shower. And a way to know that you're looking in the direction is in the northeast, right around 11 and 12, you know, midnight, there's a blue star that's very bright called Vega. And it's 25 light years away. That's the constellation of where these meteors are coming from. Now, always truth on your shows and everybody else that we talk with is that with the moonlight, it diminishes the number of meteors. But if it were dark, new moon, you could maybe see from a dark location 30 or 40 of these meteors. What are they? Their material, as we were talking with Paul about the devil's comet, the so-called devil comet, it's material that's blasted out of the back end of the tail of a comet. And when the Earth crosses it, it runs into this stream of particles. And I don't really like the cereal, but it's like the size of grape nut flakes, if you're familiar with that. Little grape nut, little pebbles. And they light up the night sky. They don't hit the Earth. And it's just a fascinating thing to see. And then, of course, symbolically, we move into the sacred season of Passover, which I begin, starts on the evening of the 22nd. It moves through the end of April. And that always coincides with, of course, the next beautiful full moon on the 23rd called the full pink moon in honor of, you know, growing flowers and beautiful plants in this particular spring season.
You don't like grape nuts, huh?
No, I really don't. I don't know. How about you, Frank? No.
You know, it's been a while since I had them, but I think I like them. I had a bowl of cereal right before the show for the first time in, I think, years. But I'm not a big cereal guy in general. But I think I like grape nuts. I think it was healthy enough.
It's healthy.
I thought it was okay. All right.
But I think the reason I don't like them is my mom told me to eat them when I didn't like them.
I see. All right. We're going to continue with Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. We'll get the full picture of his breakfast preferences straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight. It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
We don't get fooled again. No.
Singing about how they will not be fooled again. This was a birthday bumper music selection from Scott Hassel, who is a great person. His wife, Zena, has been a guest on this show before. I am friendly with their daughter, Jody, as well. And he is a great listener. And today's his birthday. So happy birthday, Scott Hassel. Hopefully, whatever you're doing, enjoys a lot of listening to classic rock and roll. Meantime, we are in the midst of making your wish come true. If you have hoped for enlightened conversations of a cosmic nature, because my guest for this hour is Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. We're talking about everything space-related, everything sky-related. Steve, let me ask you about this discovery that astronomers have evidently made of the biggest stellar-class black hole in our galaxy. Not long ago, black holes were, it was questionable whether they were even real. Some people thought it was science fiction. And yet, now this black hole discovered some 2,000 light-years away has a mass 33 times that of the sun. Pretty exciting discovery, I would think. What does it mean?
Well, absolutely, Frank, and you're so right. I mean, Stephen Hawking, okay, the great theoretical physicist that passed on to the infinite, his big thing was discussing and trying to formulate how these things exist, if they even did. And Nobel Prize winners, of course, actually found and got a Nobel Prize off of something when they detected and first imaged one of these big black holes. And something they found out that they give off are these things called gravitational waves. That would take 3 hours of a show just to even explain it. But what does this mean significantly? It means that the population of black holes is probably more prolific in the universe than we thought. And again, what are they? The great John Wheeler, the great physicist back in the 1930s and 40s from Princeton, he, of course, helped deduce, and he wasn't the only person to give the so-called name of black hole. It started a long time before it. But simply, without a long explanation, there are areas in the universe in which all forces of energy, matter, and everything, because remember, the four main forces in the universe are electromagnetism, the strong and weak force of gravity and gravitation. Everything, heat and light, would be pulled into this, and we have no idea where the end game is for that. I mean, does it pop out of a wormhole? Does it just disintegrate? Since probably it doesn't do that. But this discovery is significant, giving us more understanding that they're more prevalent in the universe. And Stephen Hawking, on a side note, thought one time, too, before he passed, that black holes may also be of the tiniest nature, that they could populate the universe. So, not to alarm listeners at all, I don't know this, but theoretically, they could be floating around like bubbles that you would see, like if you had a beer or a soda, you see these bubbles floating around, that they just defy all the laws of gravity and science today, something we still need to study.
Well, you lost me a little bit with that. And again, I realized in a short amount of time, this is probably something that requires a lot of depth. But when you say Stephen Hawking thought they were these tiny things that could appear bubble size of beer, do you mean on Earth?
meaning that they could float around in the universe, not necessarily like we're describing, as you're asking, about the largest ones. But Stephen Hawking also said that the prevalence of these black holes, they could literally pop up in any location and not necessarily be these big, massive objects.
Wow.
And that is bizarre because, you know, if you think about this, he even went on to say that for the longest time, people thought that nothing escapes a black hole. Well, Stephen Hawking actually said, no, that's not true. Now, this may sound bizarre to people when I say that he came up and deduced that black holes have hair. Now, I haven't lost my mind in the show at all, but what does that mean? He meant that there were these tiny little spikes that would be coming out of a black hole that they do have leakage. And it was just the opposite of what most people thought. So the whole concept of these black holes, just to put it to rest, he said that they're not only these things that are pulling in all the energy, like the whole electromagnetic spectrum and all the other things, gravity and everything, is that they also may permeate the universe and pop in and out of the reality that we exist in here today. That's a strange one, isn't it?
It is indeed. Thomas is in Baltimore listening on WCBM. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, how you doing?
Great.
Yeah, my question is, for humans to do deep space travel, they're going to have to find a way to bend space and time?
Yes, absolutely. And you do bend space-time, and the existence, let's go back to the eclipses, Thomas. Einstein, who became very famous after his 1915 general and, you know, special theory of relativity, they actually observed, and his theory was this, around the sun, the gravity of the sun, he would say, warp space-time. And how would they detect that? They knew certain stars would be at the edge of the sun at the eclipse, like many people saw. And what they did, they deduced that Einstein was right. So in order for us to be able to move through space-time and travel at a quicker and faster velocity, there would be this almost impossible thing to try to do, and that is what? Warp the very existence of space-time, and that's something that nobody knows how to do, because, Thomas, they believe that the arrow of time just moves forward, not backward. So if we could do that, and Frank, this is more in your realm when we talk about extraterrestrials, maybe the vehicle of transportation across large distances is, like we're talking about, Thomas, the warpage of space-time. Mm. And civilizations or beings that know how to do that, that would be necessary to move faster through space.
Interesting. 800-848-9222. Apparently, the James Webb Telescope detected the origins of the brightest cosmic blast since the Big Bang. It apparently occurred 2 years ago, but we're just hearing about this now. Researchers discovered the brightest gamma ray burst ever recorded, which they're calling the BOAT. For the brightest mm-hmm. of all time. I would think this is a pretty consequential and exciting discovery.
It is, and hopefully we can spend time in a future Cosmic Conversation program talking about all of the things from A to Z that the James Webb Telescope has done. It's actually giving cosmologists, the people who study the creation of the universe scientifically, a lot of sleepless nights. So with this particular subject, we're now looking at something 2.4 billion light years away, Frank. And if the universe supposedly began 13.77 billion years ago, we're seeing something in space that is overpowering the brightest of all these gamma ray bursters. Now, nobody understands the mechanism behind this, but could you imagine 100 trillion times the energy output of the sun in relatively short time, seconds or minutes? Now, that's just off the charts, isn't it? So they're detecting this blast from space. It could be, and these are just speculative from a scientific standpoint, the origin of these could theoretically be these particular neutron stars or these particular stars that vibrate. If you looked at this pulsar, it's vibrating, and it has what's called star quakes on it. So the surface of this star, which you couldn't escape the gravity of, has these quakes, and out of it, somehow, a mechanism of energy release from these things is just off the charts. That is just like the most powerful signal. And if it's extraterrestrial in origin, that's totally mind-boggling because that's a powerful source.
That's for sure. Frederick is in Brooklyn. Hi, Frederick.
Yes, good morning, Frank and Dr. Good. Sky.
Good morning,
my good morning. My concern is, are there seasonal temperatures on Mars? And if so, what would be the hottest temperature inland.
Right. It is. Does Mars have a summer, winter, spring, and so forth?
Yes. No, Frederick, good morning again. This is interesting. Yes, Mars does indeed have weather, as all these planets do. And the temperatures on the daytime surface of Mars, in the highest, I believe, have reached upwards in the 40-plus degree Fahrenheit scale. But typical, if you look at the whole Perseverance rover, they have a section on the website which shows you the latest Mars weather, and it's measured in what they call their days, or sols, S-O-L-S. Now, the temperature can get as cold in the daytime, I'm sure like about 5 degrees above zero, maybe less. But at night, Frederick, is where the temperature really goes down. You're looking at maybe 175 to 180 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. And then you have to contend with the weather systems on Mars. When it gets close to the sun, Mars, as we look at climate change here in the world, pro or con, whatever people want to believe, take a look at Mars as an example. It doesn't have just dust storms like we have in Arizona or places in the Middle East. They have global dust storms, Frederick, and they can last for an entire year. And how do we know it? I've observed Mars through the telescope, and every time it got close to the Earth, you better get your viewing in, because guess what happens a few weeks later? On occasion, the dust storm covers the entire planet, and it just looks like a big purple, a big orange or reddish ball with no detail. So the temperatures on Mars, Martian weather is quite fascinating, including winds of over 250 miles an hour during dust storms.
Speaking of other planets, let me ask you about Pluto. Astrophysicists mm-hmm. apparently believe that the mystery of Pluto's heart-shaped structure, that they conclude that it was created with a 400-mile-wide planetary object early in its history. And they are also saying that Pluto has no subsurface ocean. I don't know that I even really realized that Pluto was heart-shaped. So they're saying that something hit it?
Well, yes, there's a structure on that from the, you know, from the spacecraft that passed there, New Horizons. And in the legacy of Dr. Tombaugh, they obviously named all these different features, but they see this heart-shaped area on the surface. So it looks like remnants of an impactor. So something might have slammed into, as in many cases. Look at the Earth. Where did our moon come from? It didn't come from birthing out of the Earth, as many people taught us in, you know, basic school when we were young. This particular object, and I say the word planet Pluto because I'm so on that kick, Frank, that I hope they return it, because they threw it out and called it a dwarf.
Oh, I think it's terrible. Story. It should definitely be
it
back.
Is. It has five moons, one of which, by the way, is called the satellite Charon, so C-H-A-R-O-N, discovered by a good friend of ours here in Arizona in 1978, a guy by the name of Bob Christie. Well, here's the point about Charon. It's a locked-on rotating object like the moon is, a synchronous rotator. So in other words, when you look at the surface of the moon, you see the same surface. You don't see the far side of the moon, even though it's turning. So that Charon moon and the other four, it's a whole little planetary system. So, oh my gosh, not just because Dr. Tombaugh was the guy I went to school with, the discoverer, but the point is, on a serious note, let's revise the definition of planet, because that's where the whole problem came from.
Let's see if we can squeeze in one more quick one here. Paulie is in Westwood. What's your question, Paulie?
Thank you for taking my call. I have one question. Dr. Sky, it's great listening to you. When Frank takes over the station, I hope he gets a slot for you. But when you land on a planet, why do you land on top and you don't go inside the planet itself? Like when you land on Earth, you know, do you understand what I mean?
Well, in other words, you're saying, why don't you just sink through the surface? Why do you just go to hard surface?
Exactly.
Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah. Why do you want to top of the planet and not inside it?
And then, Steve, if you can do your best to answer it in 20 seconds, I know that might be unfair.
No, here we go. In all cases, we see that planets like the moon, or surface like the moon, it's solid, so you're not going to descend into the hole. If it was water or some soft surface like sand, you would sink. But everything we've done has basically landed on solid surface for the most part.
Well done. Steve, the hour always flies by whenever we get together. I'll look forward to doing this again in 2 weeks.
Thank you, Frank, and keep your eyes to the skies. There you go.
Indeed, and in the words of the great Casey Kasem, keep reaching for the stars, but always keep your feet firmly planted on the ground.